Hi, y'all. This is Kim with Wild Orgasmic Wisdom. Just wanted to welcome you back to the WOW podcast. I've been on a bit of a hiatus, so a lot of the episodes you're going to hear coming up are back from 2020, when things were a little bit different. We were just entering the pandemic season. So just wanted to make you aware of that, and also would love to invite you to rate, review, or subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. It would really help me out and to help others find my podcast. If you have any ideas for things you'd like me to talk about or guests you'd like me to interview, please feel free to contact me. Thank you so much. Welcome back to the Wild Orgasmic Wisdom podcast, where we explore the unified field of ecstatic genius underlying our everyday realities. I'm your host and quantum priestess, Kimberly Baudet. My guest today is the founder of Wellcelium, an online school providing the skills you need for great sex and healthy relationships. Pavani is a somatic sex therapist and educator. He hosts the podcast Bespoken Bones, Ancestors of the Crossroads of Sex, Magic, and Science. As a queer trans witch, Pavani walks the glitter path of dancing bones, ridiculous delight, and old magic. So please welcome to the show with me, Dr. Pavani Murray. Welcome, Pavani.
Hey, Kimberly. Thank you. It's so good to be with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on the show. Really excited to get to talk to you today.
Likewise.
So just to start out, can you share with our guests a little bit about your mission and maybe your transmission, what you bring to your clients?
Sure. Yeah, I vision a world of radical erotic wellness in which power is handled ethically and consensually, and everyone has a really strong attunement in their own body with what that means, right? So that kind of the way things are now in terms of rape culture and extraction and earth, the way that we're damaging the earth is, it's just not really possible because we're so in our bodies and we feel our aliveness so much that we can't do things that are out of alignment with that. So that's what I'm working for. That's the world that I'm dreaming into being and actively creating.
Wow, that sounds great. Sounds good to me. I'm on board. So you talk in your podcast about feeling good and going deep, and I'm all about feeling good and going deep. So how do you invite people to feel good and go deep?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the number one thing is, how do we get the should off of ourselves? Like, we should feel like this, or it's best to feel like this, or some emotions are okay, some sensations okay, others are not, right? And how do we return to a body trust, a wisdom of what our soma, our body offers us that says, this is what feels good for me. Like, if you ever were strongly encouraged to eat your vegetables, right? Like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, someone else thinks that this is what's best for your body. And it actually may be really helpful for your body, right? But unless it comes from a place of like, oh my gosh, I want some kale right now, right? Broccoli is delicious. Unless it comes from that place, it's a should. And we do this all the time with our pleasure, with our embodiment practices, right? Of like what we think we should be doing. We should be exercising. We should be moving. We should be masturbating. We should be la, 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 la. Our sexuality should respond on demand. Like, whenever I'm ready, it should be ready, right? And there's this lack of internal consensus, right? Of kind of brain-body alignment, that they're going at different speeds. And the invitation that I'm inviting folks into all the time is like, how do you get on the same page with yourself? How do you slow down enough? How do you listen deeply enough so that whatever feels good for you is okay, right? And it's a process of permission giving, really allowing, like, even if the thing that feels good to you, maybe it shouldn't, or you think it shouldn't, or you have some kind of judgment about it, or maybe you think you should feel good in particular ways, like getting that out of the way, just being like, okay, like, how do I learn to be present with what is in my body right now, trust it, listen to it, follow it, and say it's okay, and not not shame myself for it. So that's the feel good part, that it's highly individual, and it's highly individual in each moment, right? It's not, I know what makes me feel good. This always makes me feel good, right? It's a process, like being consensual is a process of responding in the moment to what is, yeah? And even if it's different than it was 10 minutes ago or yesterday, right? That there's a, that dialogue, that deeply attuned dialogue is happening internally all the time, right? So you see how this is kind of relating back to the thing I said about my mission, yeah? And in terms of going deep, I'm a somatics practitioner. And so what that means is that the body is really leading the conversation. So going deep means going into the body in a way where you're placing your attention inside your experience, right? So my attention, like often our attention is kind of like up here or even out here. And like, what's it like to be able to place my attention inside my body? What's it like to be able to place my attention on my spine, for example, right? And maybe folks who are listening can just like check that out for a minute. Like, yeah, I have a spine and it moves in all of these interesting ways, right? And I can feel the pressure of the chair behind me. What's it like to, yeah, have that attention at the skeletal level? What's it like to have that attention at the muscular level, at the fascia level, at the organ level, at the cellular level, right? Like you think that you're just like one thing, but you're actually a collection of like billions of cells and beings. And so there's this whole, your whole universe unto yourself, right? And so going deep means really allowing your attention to permeate on all those different levels and at will, right? That's the practice of like being able to place your attention at will. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the concept of self consent, of having consent with yourself, of being on the same page as yourself. That's something that I don't hear being talked about a lot. We're starting to get into consent culture. You know, collectively as a culture, we're starting to wake up to this more and more, but having consent with the self is the first step, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it starts with really being able to see or observe all the ways that we are pushing through, that we're enduring, that we're forcing, that we're bullying ourselves, right? Yeah. And that's everything from like, I mean, self-talk, the way we talk to ourselves inside our heads about ourselves, right? I have a lot of clients who, they talk about things like, oh, I'm lazy, right? I'm like, that's not a thing. Like, there's no such thing as lazy, right? You are having an experience of resistance maybe, and that resistance is taking care of something, right? And so how do you listen to that part of yourself that is trying to care for something important?
Beautiful. Yeah, really honoring those voices instead of like, oh, you shouldn't be here, get out of here.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, so what are your suggestions, or what has been your personal experience in dealing with a culture that is absolutely not reflecting that wisdom back to us, that is maybe just actively contradicting that inner wisdom of being present, placing the awareness deep inside of ourselves, the culture that's constantly trying to pull us out of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's true in certain ways, yeah. And like, that's the place that we have choice and free will, that we become, or we can become, really deeply habituated, right? I know that I'm in my habits when I am waking up out of bed and reaching for my cell phone, right? Instead of like stretching and being in the deliciousness of my body, yeah? And so there's always that choice, right? We can always choose to check out. We can always choose to live by habit. And in some ways that can be really helpful, in many ways actually, because I don't want to be, you know, a Nazi of embodiment, like, and saying you must be embodied, like that's the way to do it. And it's not true, right? That there's the reasons that we check out, the reasons that we dissociate are to take care of something. Yeah. And it's really about having the choice, again, of the choice of the awareness of like, where do I just want to watch Netflix, you know, and where do I want to do that? And where do I want to be in this deep attunement? Yeah. And having the skills and the tools to be able to move the attention like that. Yeah. And so I think that if folks are in choice, if they feel like they have that choice about that, it's not a problem, right? But it's only when we don't know how to tune into ourselves, right? We don't know how to get into our bodies. We don't know how to feel ourselves or feel our feelings, or we don't have the capacity for all of the sensations or all of the emotions. Yeah, that's when it becomes problematic. Like we've checked out too far, and we have to figure our way back in. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, I mean, we live in a culture that, it's weird. We get these dual messages, right? About like sexuality is everything, like be sexual all the time. Like that we use sex to sell everything. And then at the same time, deeply sex negative culture. And I would say in particular, pleasure negative, like deep pleasure, deep enduring, lasting pleasure, pleasure for bodies that look different, than, you know, kind of the, what we see as the norm in advertising, right? Yeah, I do think that like we do have choice and we do have free will here of like how do we place our attention. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else here. There's something revolutionary to me about doing it from inside this culture. You know, from like not having to like step out and be some like erotic hermit that lives in a cave, you know, and they're outside of culture. I can practice embodiment and pleasure, like to be like right here in this beating, pulsing heart of capitalism and say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get to do this. Yeah. And I think that like there's small ways that we can practice that activism every day.
Totally. Yeah. And while you were speaking, I was thinking about, you know, my own struggles and the struggles of people I've known of being able to make that choice, maybe consciously in each moment of like, you know, what am I choosing in this moment? Why am I choosing it? Am I doing it because I need it? Am I doing it because I have an addiction? What do you think about sort of addiction and mental illness as it's known? I'd put air quotes on that because I feel like it's, the illness is not necessarily originating in the individuals.
Yeah, I mean, what do I think about it? There's several things. One, the stigmatization of folks who are divergent in many ways, right? There is something about needing a place to put cultural shadow, you know, of like needing a place to project like the mad, the crazy, the bad, the black, the fat, the queer, you know, that all of those identities or experiences hold a certain piece of, cultural shadow, I think is the best way to put it, of saying like that's other, that's wrong, that's not the way. And I mean, I think we all know at this point that those experiences, my experience of otherness is one of, it's offered so much in terms of personal freedom, right? Like meaning that when you're living inside of an experience that is not quote unquote mainstream, it's like the rules can't really apply to you in the same way, right? So I have a lot of, clients, young women, who are really anxious, and they're anxious about their bodies, and they're anxious about, are they going to get married, and are they going to, you know, there are certain freedoms that are given that come with the kinds of, like, I mean, it's weird to say it, but like, there are certain freedoms that come with certain kinds of oppressions, right? And that is one of them. And so like, in terms of mental illness, I mean, there's a couple of things to say about it. One, on the spiritual level, I often wonder about, you know, how those humans are being impacted by unseen forces, like spirits, you know, ghosts, and what's, you know, kind of what's going on there? Because I know that, like, there was a point in my own healing process where I started to realize that those critical voices, the ones that that told me I was crazy or told me that I was whatever, unlovable, those weren't actually my voices. And whether those were absorbed through culture or through something other than culture, you know, I don't know. But it started to be a process of, like, recognizing that that impact wasn't internal, right? It had become internalized, but it really wasn't. And so I wonder that sometimes about with folks who are mad, of like, or who are experiencing, you know, what is called mental illness, like, you know, what is native to the person and what is not, and how to help folks with that. And I have a colleague, Gogo Ekaya, who has really walked that journey of like, okay, what is it to walk into madness, and what is it to recognize it on a spiritual level? So there's that piece. Yeah, and then I think just also like, why are there only certain ways that are okay to be creative in the world, right? That as long as there is, I think we could do a much better job of supporting folks to be how they are in their bodies and in their lives, right? Without necessarily pathologizing them. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That seems to be something that's been coming up a lot for me recently, is just how easy it is to believe that someone's defective just because they function differently than you do. Mm-hmm. And certainly their behavior, as well as like your own, may be influenced by trauma or ancestral wounds, as we might get into. But just the capacity to acknowledge that, like, you think differently, you do things differently, and that's okay. You know, and part of this collective shadow I like to include in the cultural shadow, you know, like murderers, rapists, like, you know, people who just do the things that even the most liberal people have a hard time accepting, let's say. But even if we were to get to a point in our culture where we can not necessarily give those people a place where they have the access to hurt other people, but just to understand, like, this person is perceiving reality differently. How can we, you know, think of this person as like our mentally ill uncle, or, you know, as opposed to pushing them so far out of society that we're completely disowning them as part of our own shadow? What do you think about that? I kind of just threw a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, what comes up is, I think, like, that there's places that those behaviors are sanctioned, like during war. You know, that those behaviors have been completely sanctioned. And so it's confusing of like, why is it, you know, why is the death penalty okay, for example? Or why is police violence against Black men okay? That, why is that not murder? You know, like, and so, I mean, it is, in my opinion, yeah. It is murder, right? And so I think that there's the piece about the shadow stuff, but there's also the piece about like living with what you've done, right? You become the things that you've done. You become the things that have happened to you. Like, those are part of you and part of your story and part of your experience as a human. And I don't know that it's as simple as what came to me recently is that there is a feeling of worthiness that I experience in terms of like, I get to live in accordance with my values, right? Like, there's a, and that when I step outside of that, it has impact. It has impact on the world, sure, right? Like, if I were, I mean, obviously I'm not a murderer and I have never killed anyone. And if I were to do that, that would be against my values, right? And that if I were to do that, that would become part of who I am, right? Maybe not that identity, but that experience. And that at least at this point in my life, I feel well enough that I don't want to do that. Like, it's important enough to me, not for any kind of like ethical code of society, but just because, like, in my heart, in my body, it wouldn't feel right. It doesn't feel right, you know? And and so, like, what's it like to value ourselves in that way of, I don't want to live with the consequences of things that I have perpetuated, right? That aren't in attunement with my values. So I'm not going to make those choices. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. What's coming to me now is more of the ancestral stuff that you work with and talk about. And I just want to mention that it seems like some people who do things like that, who commit murder or whatever, in their lifetime, we don't necessarily see that they are able to come to a place of reflecting on that or like fully confronting it or being like, oh my God, you know, feeling the weight of that mm-hmm. impact. But for example, if some of our ancestors did things like that, we might be feeling the weight of that impact in our lifetime. Do you agree with that?
100%. Yeah, 100%. I agree with that. And I think it's an important accounting in terms of, like, can I turn towards anything that my ancestors did or experienced or was done to them, can I turn towards those harms? And can I face them? And can I do it in a way that is like appropriately accountable, loving, but not bypassy, right?
Yeah.
Can I face, like, so for example, I know that my ancestors, I'm of European descent, and my ancestors participated in genocide of Native folks in Ohio, where they lived. And I know that because I have stories of that, right? And so part of the work that I've done around that is to, like, okay, how do I look at that? And how do I see the impact of that? How do I feel the impact of that, of not just what was done to the Native folks, but also the, like, what was done to my people by doing that, right? And how does that live in me? And how does that, there can be a numbness around it of, like, oh, I don't want to look at that, or I don't want to feel that. I don't want to feel the impact of that, the weight of that. It will be overwhelming, right? So how do I, in titrated amounts, you know? And I've heard this also from folks whose people own slaves, right? Of, like, what do I do with this? You know, I have heard it from folks whose ancestors were Nazis. What do I do with this? How do I both embrace my ancestry and not be complicit, not say that those things are okay? And I just want to distance myself. And that's, that makes sense to me why I want to. And I don't think it's super helpful, right? Of, like, how do we, my way is to turn towards it and to turn towards it with backup, with ritual skill and safety of how do we start to address these harms, because they don't go away. Like, transgenerational trauma is a thing because it doesn't just go away when somebody dies, right? Like, this stuff does get passed down through the generations. And I think we're all to some degree living proof of that, right? That it's a thing. And so how do we turn our attention towards that as well? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, how would you describe the practice, or the maybe even the physical sensation, if there is one, of being able to hold space not only for victims, because I think that it's normal, it's easier in our culture to hold space for victims, at least for some of us, but for holding space for perpetrators, like, how can we do that ethically and in congruence with our values?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can speak to it personally, and I can also speak to it, like, more kind of like philosophically. I think I'll start with the personal. I mean, I think that on the personal level, what I want to say about it is that I wouldn't say it's a holding space. I would say this turning towards technology of, like, turning and looking at, right? Turning our attention towards whatever situation happened, whatever harm was done. So in the case of my ancestors, really turning towards that those stories, those ancestors, the land on which they happened, reading firsthand accounts of things that happened, trying my best to understand the impact that was created by my colonizer ancestors, trying to feel that, like, a lot, like, because I imagine that in order to do those things, what they had to do internally was to shut down their own, it's like if you turn off somebody else's humanity, you're also turning off your humanity, right? And so in order to inflict brutality and that kind of harm, you have to be disconnected from your own humanity. And so what is the corrective to that is to be willing to feel it, right? And so at my end of things, there's been a lot of ritual, there's been a lot of grief, offerings, tendings, trying to make what reparations I can on the personal level to the folks who were harmed. In the case of those people, they were completely decimated from Ohio. Like, they're not, they're only existing in the place names at this point. And so it's, you know, making connections with other Indigenous groups and making reparations, financial reparations. And just like really being willing to see and acknowledge that those things happened, and they happened for the sake of land ownership and capitalism. And like, it's not like, you know, I don't know about you, but did you get fed that, like, oh, let's make a turkey hen for Thanksgiving, right? Like the natives and the pilgrims sitting down, like, no, that's bullshit, right? That's not what happens. And that kind of accounting and that kind of feeling accounting, just being like, oh my God, this is, you know, in no way okay. And what happened wasn't okay. And like, I can allow that to be grieved in me, right? That's been like a real, all those things have been important steps. And I think it's just kind of like a lifelong process. Like, I don't know that it gets to a point where you're just like, okay, cool, healed, right? Like, it's kind of like healing any kind of trauma, slowly over time with repetition and by like just being willing to keep unpeeling layers of the onion of the stories of the ways that we make repair, the understandings that we have of I'll stop there.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Just based on what you said now, I just want to briefly touch on the aspect of, I'm just speaking more of like American culture, even though I'm in France right now, but American culture I know better than any other culture. And obviously our president has some interesting problems and there's a lot of people in power who have some interesting problems right now. And it's easy, I think, to feel really powerless in the face of that because it seems like we're kind of underneath a structure that's crushing us and crushing a lot of marginalized groups and minorities. Do you have some thoughts on how we can step into a place of empowerment around not necessarily dragging these people through the mud, because that's obviously not going to change much, but how to kind of just step into a place of power around these systems?
Yeah, this is great. I love this question. We are simultaneously very powerful and very powerless, right? That's true. That's happening in your body. It's happening in my body. It's happening wherever we look, in everyone's body, right? That we're a paradox of personal power and living in systems that are crushing and that intend to be crushing, right? And powerlessness is the thing that we hate feeling the most. Like, none of us want to feel powerless. And we'll do lots and lots of things to avoid feeling powerless. Like, number one being shame, and that we'll shame ourselves and to retain our agency. It's like, well, what if we just got, like, this is going to sound a little ironic, but like, what if we got good at feeling powerless? Like, because there is a certain surrender to it of like, okay, you know, there are many, many institutions that I cannot impact, right? My sex magic, my orgasmic wisdom, that's what your thing is, right?
Or yeah.
Like that, there's some things that that's just not going to impact, you know, but that's okay. Cause I can just like surrender into the changing what I can and leaving the rest, right? Of like, where does it serve me to admit powerlessness and just be like, yeah, can't do much about that, right? And where does it serve me to step more fully into my power and say, okay, here are the things that I can do. Here's where I do want to put my fight energy, right? Is into these things. And I think that that's a really personal decision for everyone. Like I personally want to put my energy into things where I can see my impact, right? Like I don't want to spend my life struggling for something and never knowing the impact that I've had, because like I don't want to feel that powerless, right? Like I want to know that it's like a little bit impactful and a little bit of power. And so for me, you know, that's my work of really steering attention into that. And for other people, it might be their family, right? It might be their home. It might be their garden. Of like, where can I find the places where I feel really powerful? Yeah. So it's, for me, it's like it's an internal somatic paradox, which we're fraught with anyway, of like, okay, how do I just like relax the part of me that feels powerless and just be like, yeah, I got no power over there. And put over here, this is where I do. And I would say that also, collective power, like how do we learn to share power with others in terms of like anarchist organizing or, you know, kind of any kind of activism where we're sharing power? How do we come together and share power and so that we can have even greater impact, right? And I think that there's a lot of power in that. Yeah
totally.
Can I get at your question?
I think so.
Feel more empowered.
Yeah. So I want to, let's go down another path here. On your podcast, you talk somewhat about like the blessings and burdens of sexual ancestry, of the ancestry that we carry that influences our sexuality. I guess what I'm curious about is that, do the blessings and burdens of our sexual ancestry always sort of balance each other out? Or do you think it's possible to move into a world where we heal more of our ancestral wounds and experience just our sexual gifts and blessings?
Well, I hope that's the idea.
Right? Great.
Yes. The answer is yes.
Yay.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you know, you get handed a package when you're born, right? And it has the blessings and the burdens of your people, right? And you didn't ask for that. It's just what you get, right? And that includes the things that happened, like we talked about. It includes the attitudes, beliefs, practices, religious dogmas, sexual freedom, any kind of talents, any kinds of, you can trace this back to a place you can really see this is, you know, kind of what are the blessings and burdens you just got from your family of origin, right? Of around sex. Like, did your family talk about sex? Were you encouraged to explore sexually? Did your parents shut down your sexuality? Were you prohibited from masturbating and shamed for it? Were you, did you get pregnant and you were kicked out of your house? Were you celebrated when your sexuality started to explode in your body? Were you shown, you know, good and ethical ways to be with yourself? Did your parents teach you about consent? Like all these things, you can look at and you can say, okay, like you can do an assessment and say, okay, this is the hand that I got dealt. And it doesn't mean it's going to be the hand you die with, right? But it does mean that all those things can be unpacked. And and so the burdens piece, there might be some things that need to be resolved, right? Especially if there's transgenerational sexual trauma. And that includes religious trauma. Like it includes trauma from Catholicism, for example, or any kind of really conservative religion. can really traumatize sexuality in development. And so some of that stuff, yeah, can be unpacked and healed. And then it's kind of like once that stuff's out of the way, you can step even more fully into those sexual blessings. And those might be things like lasciviousness. You might be super sex positive, super permission giving. You might be a great, fun lover. You might be really exploratory. You might have really great sensate potential in your body. You know, you might be multi-orgasmic, and you might be able to help other people heal. You know, there's all of these like wonderful things about your sexuality that's not just sex, right? And once the kind of some of the burdens that are in the way kind of get addressed, then those things are just easier to access and easier to embody and easier to share. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I was really excited when you talked about, I've never heard the term erotically gifted. And when you said that on your podcast intro, I was like, that's me. Like, I feel like I'm erotically gifted. And I'm just imagining what the culture would be like if we did give permission to sexual gifts, because, you know, there's something about childhood and sexuality, you know, amongst all the other sexual trauma and repression that's going on. But there's something about sexuality in childhood that people are so freaked out about. It's very, very totally taboo. And there's obviously a lot of stuff to unpack around that. There are reasons why that is. Yeah, just speaking personally, for some reason, I didn't really absorb a lot of like the sexual shame, or at least I was able to kind of like understand it, even if it is perhaps part of my makeup unconsciously. But I was taught that sexuality belonged kind of like in a box over here. Like that was the message that I got from my family of origin, was like, sexuality exists, but it's not part of like the world. It's like this thing that's over here that you just like go to
visit time to time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that was really a question. It was more just like me wanting to connect with that and express how beautiful I think it is that people be acknowledged for sexual gifts and to be able to embrace their sexuality in a way that's deeper and wider than just like, oh, this, you know, is just this dirty little thing you keep in a box.
Right, exactly. Like weaving it throughout your life. Yeah.
So two terms that often come up in the spiritual community are divine feminine and divine masculine. Like we hear that all the time. Sure. So this obviously can leave a gap for queer and trans people. What's a clear way for trans people to connect with their own divinity that's not necessarily tapping into that divine masculine or divine feminine?
Yeah, that's great. Okay, I have a lot to say about this. Yes. So, all right, let's just talk about what is this experience of the divine masculine or divine feminine. Let's just talk about that first, right? Like, what is that? When people say that, what are they even talking about? You know, it's like saying erotic energy. Like, what the fuck are you even talking about? You know, we use shortcuts in language and we use them for the sake of communication and ease. But we're often not even on the same page on what we're talking about, you know? And so if I say the divine feminine, what I'm referring to is some kind of internal experience that I am having. And maybe it's a transcendent experience, right? Maybe it's a experience that connects me to something greater than myself. And maybe that has a certain felt sense of that. And from that set of sensations, right, that expansive, connected, flowing, whatever set of sensations, whatever it feels like I feel like I'm, you know, bigger than the planet and I'm floating around and I'm hot in my core, you know, whatever that experience is that people are just like shorthanding divine feminine. There is something, yeah, there's something really profound that they're experiencing and that's happening. Yeah. But the problem is that doesn't get conveyed. Right. And so if you're like, oh yeah, I was hanging out with the divine feminine this weekend, Pavani, I'll be like, cool, Kimberly, like, were you in a divine feminine ritual? Like, what, you know what I mean? Like, what does it even mean? Right. So like, what would it be like if we had language to, and I think that this really comes from not having nuanced enough language to talk about our internal somatic landscape, right? We have a very hard time saying, oh, this is what it feels like inside of me, right? And so there's that. The other piece is that we want to make meaning. We are little meaning-making monkeys, right? Of taking a set of sensations that we have and creating narrative around it, right? So that's the other piece of how this language thing comes in. So I think that's how we get to using this language, right? Maybe there's another piece of something like archetypal, of like wanting to connect with something that can give us guidance for the meaning of our own lives, right? So if I'm connecting with the divine masculine, maybe I'm, connecting somehow with something that is informing my life and giving my particular life more meaning. Yeah, so it's not just like the meaning of this experience, it's like my individual life has more meaning. So yeah, I think for everyone, like some people, these, you know, who are kind of within the gender binary, trans people included, right? These words can work really well. I prefer a little more specificity because I don't really know, like when my clients say that, like I'm happy to go along with that language, but I'm like, but tell me what that really means to you. What does that feel like? How do you know it? What is it? How do you experience the divine feminine in your hips or in your torso or in your shoulders? Like how are you actually knowing that feeling? There's like just the gender binary in general is super limiting, right? It, like you get two choices, and I have met very few people, because I do these exercises with people with groups. I'll be like, okay, here's the gender binary. If you're a manly man, go over here. And if you're a girly lady, go over here. And like people revolt. Like, okay, put yourself on the binary. They like revolt. They're like, no, I won't. I'm going to stand over here. I'm leaving the room. Right. And so like, okay. And this is like with just like regular groups of folks, right? Like at professional conferences, you know? So there's this, I think this experience that many of us have that it just doesn't fit so well for us. Like there's parts of both that we might feel or that we might experience. Seriously, in like 10 years of doing that exercise, I have never seen it be like, okay, all the people who identify as men, or, you know, it just doesn't work like that. And so I guess one question is, if that language comes up, who does it include and who does it exclude, right? Like, can a person with a cock be included in an experience celebrating the divine feminine, for example, right? Or is it, you know, excluded? Is there an exclusion that happens? And I don't know that it's like necessarily bad that an exclusion happens if it's upfront. I think that the harmful part of the binary is that it just like limits our options. Yeah. So for, okay, and getting back to the other part of your question now about trans folks, that was my rant about divine masculine and divine feminine. So for trans folks who want to, and who don't identify with the gender binary and who don't want to experience the divine masculine or the divine feminine, whatever that means to them, there's all of these great gender fluid deities. In every culture, there are gender fluid deities. I have a whole list of like 200 or 300 of them, right? So like all around the world, there's all of these expressions of the divine that are either genderless or gender morphing or gender both or agender, or, you know, there's just like so many expressions. The gender thing is definitely a mystery, you know? And so that there is a way of being on that line of it, being in that, there's a brink of like teetering on and like being in that space of like, I was talking to somebody the other day and they're like, let me describe my gender to you. It's like this. And I was like, oh yeah, I know. That's like how it is too. I get it. Right. And so
yeah,
that piece, that space of namelessness is a divine space, right? It's a liminal space. It's a space where we're beyond gender. We're beyond binaries of all sorts, not just gender. And it's a, like, when we're in that liminality, everything becomes possible. Our magic becomes so much more potent, right? I don't know if you've ever gone to, have you ever gone to any rituals by, like, super gendered pagan rituals, where there's, like, the high priestess and the high priest, and they're, like, invoking into the cup, you know, and it's very formal. And I'm not trying to yuck their yum. I appreciate that, and it's just, it's not my jam. But, and then it's just completely different when you're just with a group of witches in the woods, and everybody's, like, rolling on the ground and hooting and hollering and, like, covered in ash and dirt and mud. And you know, for me, the structurelessness is where the magic happens. It's like the crack between the worlds. It's the way that we can bridge that gap between the seen and the unseen and spend time with the spirit realm. And that's, it's the same. Yeah. And so, like, smashing binaries is awesome. That's where I'll stop.
Hell yeah. Yeah. I think that's really exciting that in that experiment that you've done, that you've never had people that are like, oh yes, I'm fully 100% woman or whatever. I mean, just speaking from personal experience, I relate strongly to feeling like a man and feeling masculine, but you know, people don't tell me that looking at me. They always say, oh, you seem so feminine, but I have this thing that I identify with that's this very strong masculine. And yeah, I think that everybody's on a spectrum, whether they know it or not, is my personal opinion.
I was traveling in Idaho a couple of years ago with my partner. We went on a road trip and it was like, it was a Sunday. And so most of the restaurants were closed because it was church. And we found this one that was open and we like went in there and we were the only ones in there. And then like slowly the church crowd started to trickle in. But there was this, that seated at the table next to us, there's this guy and his wife. And he's like, I mean, I think he probably would have been at the, like, I'm a man if I had given him the spectrum. And he's like, So I'm listening to their conversation. They're talking with their server and he's like, do you have lemonade? And the server's like, yeah. And he's like, okay, I'll have lemonade. And then he's like, oh wait, is it pink lemonade? And the server's like, yeah. And he's like, oh, never mind, I'll have a Coke. And I was like, was it because it was pink? Because like pink lemonade is just lemonade with food coloring in it. It's not like there's pink lemons, right? I'm like, oh my gosh. So
that poor man, I hope that he got to eventually like embrace that part of them that probably
or just like had something to drink, right? Like,
right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, that's great. I would love to see that list of those deities, because that's really it's really cool. So can we talk a little bit about language, because I know that this is really, like you said, this is a sticking point for people when they're getting to know their inner landscape and their felt sense, like describing what's going on inside their body, inside their experience. Can you just give us some words of like how can we learn how to talk about that experience? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the first thing is, how can you put your attention underneath your neck, right? How can you actually practice feeling what's happening? And that takes a minute to get good at, right? Of like, you don't even have to have words at first. Like words is kind of like the next step. Like the first thing is like, oh, I notice, you know, something in my left psoas. What is it? I don't know. I can't put words to it right now. Like, and if you would ask me 10 years ago, I would have been like, down by my back on the left side. Like, I didn't even know the word psoas, right? So like, there is a power to having a sense of our own anatomy is one thing. Of like knowing where are your kidneys? Can you put your hands on them? Can you put your hands on your liver? You know, where are your thyroid? Where is that? You know, so like having that piece is kind of important, but then also being able to like feel into the body and be like, okay, so I'm going to close my eyes and I'm going to like just feel the palms of my hands, you know, really pour my attention into the palms of my hands. Right. And then everything else kind of goes offline and then it's just the palms of my hands. Well, what do I notice when I'm just hanging out with the palms of my hands? So I can feel like there's like a tiny tingling in my right ring finger and my left hand is a little bit cooler than my right hand, you know? And so temperature is one thing to notice. And that's more of a, can be more of an external experience, right? Of like the air on your skin, a movement, like if there's any kind of movements, like sometimes people will be like, it just feels like it's going like this, you know, and what they're trying to tell you is like, there's some kind of movement there that's happening. Movement, constriction. If you can, and if you can't tell if something is constricted, try to tighten it more, you know? Mm-hmm. People use words that are, that represent things kind of like in nature, often, like sinking, dropping, floating, bubbling, bristling. And there's words online, like sensation lists that you can find online of like, you know, there's, and to know that emotions and sensations are similar but yet different, right? So like, I'll often say, okay, what are you noticing inside? And someone will say, I feel some tightness in my chest, right? And I'll say, okay, so is there an emotion associated with that? Say, I feel kind of sad, right? And people get those things confused too, like sensation and emotion gets mixed up, but they are separate, kind
of. Yeah, I really like that we almost went into another paradox here of like just the power in being able to have awareness and being able to know, for example, where different muscles, different organs are, being able to name them, being able to, you know, place awareness on and then eventually name sensations. And then, you know, in this other realm, the unnaming, I like to talk about the unnaming of animals. You know, like removing the names that we've given to things in the world as a way to experience them more directly.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. Yeah, and just like another way to know ourselves is like, what if we don't have to put it in words? What if we can just like stay with the feeling, right? Stay with it just for a few more seconds and then like not... And it's like nice to be able to articulate what's going on inside of us.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I felt like there was something else I wanted to dive in around like the psychogenealogy, ancestry, magic stuff. But I also just want to hear what's alive for you right now.
You want to talk about the spirit of Eros?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So if we talk a little bit about the spirit of Eros, right? So first of all, what even is that, right? And it, again, it's a shorthand. It's a name of a felt sense thing. And when I'm speaking about Eros, what I'm speaking about is the feeling of aliveness. Right? It's not something we pay attention to a lot. Like we just kind of are alive, but there's also a feeling like when we think about all of those billions of cells that each one of them, like when I was in my 20s, I used to take psychedelics a lot and you probably can't tell. I remember this one time I was tripping and I was like, whoa, I wonder if all my cells are tripping too, you know, like this, that each cell has its own life, right? Like each organ has its own life. And so there are these processes of life that are going on inside of us. There is, you know, obviously there's some animating force, spirit, whatever you want to call it, that is in us that leaves when we die, that feeling of aliveness, and we know it through our senses, mostly through our through sight, smell, hearing, taste, touch. We also know it through our internal senses. But it's like, what is it to start to make that the center of your life, that you are alive and that you can pay attention to the feeling of aliveness within you. And we can call that Eros, right? And it's the same thing that's in every living thing, right? That the erotic moves through every tree, every leaf, every bud, every animal, every spermatozoa, every zygote. Like it's the same thing, that aliveness. And so for me, it's pretty exciting right now to think about, like, I'm kind of bored with trauma. And I know that trauma is, like, right now kind of culturally, everybody's like, oh, kind of deal with trauma. And I agree. And I don't know, maybe I just hit it a little bit ahead of everybody else. But like, at this point, I'm like, I don't know how it, I don't think it serves us to repeat our trauma narratives again and again. Like, I think once it's helpful, and more than that, we're just repeating our trauma, right? And so, like, what is the antithesis of that? Well, the antithesis of that is telling our aliveness stories, you know, of like, what's a time that you dissolved into the world in a beautiful burst of aliveness, and that everything inside you was changed by that moment? Or like, what's a moment that you were completely present today, where you just, everything stopped and you were just in that moment, right? So those, I'm super interested in these kinds of pleasure experiences. And you know, pleasure is kind of written off as like, oh, that's extra, right? Well, that's some survivalist bullshit, right? That's not extra. That is the thing, I think, of like, what's it like to, and pleasure doesn't have to mean, like, it can be grief, right? Like, pleasure can be grief. It can be sadness. It can be rage. It can be so many things, but just this like presence of feeling, this presence of aliveness. And so that's where it's at for me right now, is like following my aliveness, really trusting that like what's coming through is the right thing. That if I'm resisting something, it's because it's not the thing right now. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not being lazy. Just like, that's not where the magic is at. So like this skill of being able to sniff that out, of like, where, how do I follow this thread of aliveness? It's like almost like it's, if I was on a, in a beautiful forest, and it, the thread of aliveness was this beautiful little fairy that's dancing in front of me. And I'm just like, you know, following behind it. It's like, where is that moving in me? Yeah, so erotic every day.
Amazing, amazing. I love that. And that's exactly what Wild Orgasmic Wisdom is all about. It's about bringing, or get, like, being aware of orgasmic energy that's moving through everything, not just sexual organs when we're being sexual. Beautiful.
Completely that, yeah.
Beautiful. All right. Yeah, I'm just letting that land. I felt like I had another question, but that's pretty much it. Yeah. So yeah, aliveness, Eros, it's the cake. It's not the icing on the cake. It's the cake itself.
It's the meal.
Yeah, the whole meal. Enjoy.
The delicious raw vegan organic meal that I just lovingly prepared for you while I was naked in the kitchen.
Hell yes. All right, Pavani, anything else you'd like to share with us today before we wrap up?
No, but I can tell folks where to reach me.
Yes, please tell us where we can.
Great. So yeah, I have a school called Wilsilium, which you mentioned, and it's in the process of launching, and we have all of these amazing teachers and events around the stuff that I've been talking about. And so you can find us online at wilsilium.org, wellsilium.org, or on Instagram. Is we're having all kinds of fun stuff there. And I'm excited to share my work with you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very excited to get to know more about you and your work. And don't forget to check out P's podcast, Bespoken Bones, which is incredible, has a lot of incredible guests as well. So please check that out. And I'm going to put all the links in the notes, in the credits, so you can get that. All right. Thank you so much, Pavani. Really appreciate you being here.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye.